this means a lot to Sid and I. This is our first live event of being a podcast for a year now.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
This is generally how our podcast recordings go. So it's really, yeah, it's kind of scary to be in a place where we can't control it. We can't edit it, I guess, but that's the whole point of doing something like this. So again, thank you so much for coming. It means so much to us. This podcast literally was an idea on the back of a postcard. If you guys have got your zines, you can see the actual postcard that I sent to Sid asking her to do a podcast like this with another podcast after we reached, I think, 10,000 listens or something. We never, ever thought that we would do something like this or reach the amount of people that we have.
Yeah.
So it means so much, honestly, for you guys to be here.
Yeah, so like a year on since we had our first episode, we've had over 34,000 listeners, that's including some of you wonderful people, and 37 guests, and where would we be with our wonderful guests who lend us their voices and who tell us what they think about things, and are happy to call us in too. So we're really pleased, and thank you very much for all those things. So, thinking about creating platforms, and essentially this is what we've made here, kind of by accident. You know, platforms can take any form, really. You know, you can make a zine, maybe that one's we put on your chair, but you can also create like an alternative Twitter account. If there's one lesson we wanted to take from today,
it's you can be an activist in any way, shape or form, so you don't need to be standing outside Parliament marching all the time. Like, you use your resources available, and that's kind of what we've done, and that's our form of activism. And the people on our panel would do this way better than we do, in much more eloquent and beautifully presented ways. So I guess this is a good opportunity to hand over to our guests and let them introduce themselves. So if we maybe want to start with one of the co-editors of Ladybird.
Hi, this feels like I'm in Westlife or something. my name is Sadhbh, S-A-D-H-B-H. It's an Irish name. I am one of the co-editors of Ladybird, and I'm a cis lesbian. Do you want me to add that detail? And I'm very nervous and happy to be here.
Amazing.
Thank you so much. I'm Imri, or Imriel. One's my government, one's my nickname. I am the co-host of Millennial Millennials, the podcast, and also the CEO of the Shoutout Network, which is a podcast network for people from underrepresented backgrounds. I am a black cis woman, and yeah, that's me.
Hi, I'm Hannah, one of the co-hosts of Contented, and I'm a brown cis man. That's me.
Thank you so much for telling us and introducing us to you, especially like the listeners who will be listening later. Why was it important to you to create this space in the first place? If I can begin with you as Consented.
Well, I think like me and my friend Mike took up, and initially we just found the media like ranged from like, say, like the far right with like the Sun to like the centre right, which would be like the Guardian, and there was just like so little space for like any critical articles, particularly about race. All things are grounded in colonialism. And I think today was a really good example of this with Diane Abbott saying that Britain invented racism, which arguably is true if you look at like the history of enlightenment and colonialism, and which was like absolutely smashed in the press. And all mainstream journalists, particularly like Toby Young, went on a Twitter tirade about like what racism is in 10 useful tweets from Toby Young, which means that I really felt vindicated in making that Consented after that in particular.
So with Millennial Millennials, it was kind of an offshoot of FA, the founder of the Shoutout Network, wanting to create a podcast network. I didn't know what a podcast was. I had no intentions of ever being on one. But because we had such a hard time finding people in our demographic, and by demographic I mean like young black millennials, one, knowing what a podcast was, and two, understanding why we wanted to do it, I said, oh, I'll ask Satya, who's my co-host, does she want to start one, just to kind of give people a feel for what a podcast is and what we wanted it to look like. And we actually didn't anticipate that it would be kind of the juggernaut that it is today. So it was very much, here's what we wanted, and here's what we feel like we're lacking as black British women. Everything that we were consuming at the time was very US-centric. It was focused on US politics, Black Lives Matter was active at the time. And I just remember feeling like really affected mentally by everything that was happening. I was like, this is not my classroom experience. This is not my day-to-day experience. It's not to say that these things aren't happening to a degree in the UK, but this is not my experience. And we kind of focus on what's happening here. So that's how my millennials sort of started and kind of inspired the rest of the kind of podcasts on the network to get on board.
So with Lady Beard, kind of similar to Consented, but from a feminist angle, we actually had the idea originally in 2012, but then like we had degrees to do, so we couldn't do it for a while. We wanted to reflect back on what mainstream women's so-called media was giving us and reapproach the topics that they kind of hit again and again and again, but only did in very like similar ways that represented very few experiences. So we do themed issues that take very, very broad topics and then try and have as many voices and experiences talking about the ways that they interact with those topics and actually remove ourselves as much as possible from the editorial voice, because as an editorial team of three white women, we actually dominate the conversation in mainstream women's media. So we don't write anything, we commission out. And so I guess to kind of go back to the question, what I've actually forgotten as I said that, but there are themes that are hammered again and again and again, but they're not approached in interesting or nuanced or ways that reflect lived experience, and we wanted to create something that did that in a celebratory way.
Right, and that's super interesting. You kind of touched on two points there, which I think resonate quite a lot with Sid and I, in that you had this idea quite a while before actually starting it, which is something that Sid and I, this was like brewing. You can see in the zine, it was spring in like October 2015, and it was before May until we started released our first episode. But also how that you make sure that you're not at the centre of the conversation, and that's something that Sid and I really try hard to do, is make sure that, like you said, that we actually dominate what the media is for women. And so it's really interesting, and that's what drew us to Lady Beard. It's a fantastic magazine, and I think your strapline is that you take the format of a glossy magazine and revolutionise the content, and they absolutely do. So how do you guys work with people? Because Sid and I, we're friends first, and that has been an experience in itself. And I mean, can we say business partners or like entrepreneurs? I'm not sure, but we started something together, and that's been interesting, working together and finding ways to do that. How do you guys do it? I guess we can start with Emil.
With great difficulty, actually. It is tough because I occupy like three spaces with my co-host. So she was my friend first. I then became the CEO of the network that controls our podcast, and I'm also her co-host, which is a conflict for the network and also for myself. So I'm literally sitting in these three positions, and when it came, we had a really difficult time, especially like around what the network was, what it would mean, how you're my friend, but can you please sign this contract, which gives like rights to the network. It was a very difficult conversation to navigate, and I think actually we're still kind of feeling some of the effects of that conversation. So I think for now, like when it comes to the podcast, we do kind of keep them quite separate, we keep them quite compartmentalized, in that it works better for us to be able to see each other every week, create a really good show that resonates with those people, and then our friendship has to kind of be something else, and it's kind of changed the way our friendship is a little bit. I'm not sure if it's for the better yet, I think it's too soon to tell, but it is really difficult to kind of navigate that, so be mindful of who you go into business with, not as like an ominous warning, but just it does change things. I think, yeah, like we have like loads of like bickering things on WhatsApp, like really petty stuff that you wouldn't anticipate happening in the beginning because it's all really fun, and then it actually becomes work somewhere along the way. That happens, so be prepared for that.
For us, it was very emotionally intense, as we had to like basically break down the walls of like things that you wouldn't say to your friend, and being like, that pitch that you just sent out, it's shit. Like, we can't, like, all of those kind of parameters you set for how you deal with people, for us at least, have been completely broken down, and I've never been so frank with anyone as I am with my two co-editors, Kitty and Maddie, probably to the detriment of how I speak to other people now, because I've forgotten that you can't say those kinds of things to other people. And I think that, like you were saying, that's like maybe a good thing, maybe a bad thing, but it's like, it's kind of necessary when you work really intensely on something that is a passion project and is not like, it's not a job, so you don't have those parameters. Well, one, it is a job, but it's not like a job from like on high, if you know what I mean. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, that was all pretty bleak. Like,
no, we're like such good friends, but we can just like say whatever we want to each other.
I mean, it's all like cry
success stories. Yeah. Ooh, didn't I? We're getting great. Like, you guys are killing it in the podcast world, and you guys are killing it. So, like, it works, guys.
I mean, we're all quite good pals, but like, I don't know. Like, we all get on really well, so it works quite nicely. If they annoy me, I just introduce them to people as my colleagues, not as my friends, because I feel that's like much colder. I don't know. Mike's like white. He's my white shield. Trying to keep them to like defend against white people. Then when I start calling them as like reverse racist, so it's all quite useful. Then Mike's getting married as well, which is like not really on brand. And a little bit, I feel a little bit left out of the process, really. Because we're meant to be married to consent to all of us in a polyamorous sort of open marriage, and he's going to leave us.
Damn, Mike. Wherever you are. Take note, you're not allowed to do that.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about like the things that you found difficult and how you worked through them, because that's definitely something that later I found. And I feel like things reached ahead at that point, and then now we're at a point where we work really well together, we're actually stronger because of it. But I don't think we even had an idea what we signed up to when we first started doing it. And the thing is, it just keeps growing, and it's so exciting, and people tell you that they like it, and you keep going, and then that's it. Yeah. So, how do you ensure that you're platforming a variety of voices with your platform? I know you talked about it a little bit with Lady Beard and how you ensure you're only editing us and commissioning pieces. Did you want to elaborate on that a bit?
Not really. That's like some of it. So we have open calls, and we have ideas, vague ideas, all the different ways something could be approached, and we approach people, and they give us their ideas, and we kind of like. Kind of what my old boss used to call very succinctly a spray and pray approach to commissioning, and try and get as many great ideas as possible, and then eventually, you know, page count has to come into it, and so you kind of make it more succinct.
Hmm. And what about Imri?
I don't think we actually do. I mean, we have loads of guests, we have like a really good range of guests, but I think it's very much about who we personally find interesting. Like, Melon and Lettuce is a total narcissistic project. I'm not ashamed to say that. Like, it's really narcissistic. It's people I want to meet, people that I think are really cool, people that I think have cool stories, and I just want to sit down and chat to for like an hour and a half. So that's how we pick them. And they tend to be kind of representative of us in some way, or they're reflective of me or Satya in some way. So there's kind of been a few like political activist guests that Satya is kind of more aligned with, whereas I've had like more mental health and self-care people. And I think for us, it's just about the guest has to bring a different dimension to the conversation. So we have been quite guest heavy lately. And that's because I don't know everything, and neither does Satya. And we can't just kind of sustain a show about like politics, feminism, social commentary, like law. Like, there's just too much out there, and we just don't know. So we do try to kind of find people that would resonate with our listeners more so than anything.
Fantastic. And how about
Yes, yeah, something we think about and talk about all the time. And I think similarly, like, there's only four of us, and we're quite limited in what we can do and in what we and how we see the world. So I guess we try and like talk to as many people as we can who are around us and sort of see what they're thinking, and try our best to make events as like representative as possible, like platforming different types of ideas. And also likewise, like if we think someone's really interesting, then we'll just sort of put them on a panel and listen to them, and it's quite nice to be.
So, a bit of a bold question, and feel free not to answer it, but I kind of want to ask about money, in the sense of, do you make money from it? Because as someone who is young and working, well, I hope young, working in the media and working in something like the podcast, how do you make ends meet with such like big passion projects? Do you make any money from it, or is it all passion?
Does anyone make money? We have made money here and there. It's not like anywhere near consistent. So like our live events, we charge on the door for that, or not on the door, we put tickets out. And people have supported that, which has been really useful for bringing in some cash, but it's been like, the amount of work gone into creating the live show, it wasn't paid back in any way from ticket sales. And on the network side of things, we do try to kind of reach out and be proactive with sponsors who are trying to reach our audience. So we have worked with like Ebury Publishing and BBC, and like those kinds of brands, which are really nice introductory brands for us to work with. So it kind of brings in some money, but for the most part, I think events have been the most successful for us. So like the Shout Live Festival that's coming up this summer, that is basically our Kickstarter for building our studio. Right now, the studio is built into my living room, and I need people to get out of my house. It's crazy how many guests have just walked through our house. Like, Jamelia's been in my house, it's nuts. But we need to get it out now. Like, it's, now it's just passion driving it, and we're now looking at, like, for me as like a senior, I'm now looking at it like, I need to make this profitable and sustainable business. So we are looking at how we can do that. So that's also probably going to be an annual thing, but we'll see. Hopefully it makes us enough money to build a studio.
Taking tips here.
Yeah.
Planning this.
We make a bit of money as far as it's concerned. Like, everyone who works for us gets paid. And it's quite important to us to pay. So I do so much stuff that I don't get paid for, and so many of the people that I know and work with, likewise. So we charge for the magazine, it's like £7.50, and we charge for events. And then, like, anyone who speaks at the event gets paid, and everyone who writes for the magazine gets paid. It's not great that no one's getting lifted out of poverty, and we're not going to be upending austerity anytime soon, but it's like something, I guess, at least that we try to do.
Yeah, same. We, on the team, we don't get paid. We make enough money from print, from sale of the magazine and an annual launch party, because we don't have enough energy to do anything else. And that goes back into printing the magazine and paying our contributors. So, like, I don't know, the dream is one day that we'll make money, but I've made minus money so far, and probably will continue to for a while, but that's why I have to work full time and why I'm so tired all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that Sid and I definitely relate to as well, as we've got some of our guests in the audience here, and we can't pay any of our guests right now, which is even why we're even more appreciative, because you're giving up your time. We can't cover expenses right now, but that is a goal. From doing things like this, is that eventually we can get like sponsorship and then like pay our guests at least for their covering their expenses, because one thing that we want to do is pay people for their time. That's really interesting.
So how do you manage like the work, life, passion balance? How do you do all of that and still find time for self-care, for your friends, for the people that matter?
Do we? I can't speak for you guys, but I'm knackered all the time, and my girlfriend is constantly annoyed. She's not here, so I can say that.
Don't get this recorded.
Oh yeah, it's recorded.
She won't listen until tomorrow, it's fine.
How about you two? Yeah.
That is such a good question. Well, spoiler alert, I was fired, so I was forced into doing Shout Out Network full time, which was the best thing ever to happen to me. And yeah, like, I remember going through like a bit of a mental health crisis around that time anyway, because it was a really rough year. So I kind of just remember taking that time, I was kind of forced to take time to just like chill, catch up on some sleep, and then we planned the first Shout Out Live kind of launch party. And I just remember being like 3 months just so busy and so stressed. But it was good because it was something that I loved doing, and I was really pleased with the end result. But like, I've been doing, up until about a month ago, I was doing Shout Out pretty much full time, which was a privilege, and that's because I am a kept woman and my boyfriend funds my life. he's not well paid at all, but it was kind of a privilege that I was able to kind of just live like rent free and kind of not have any responsibilities, which enabled me to kind of go full throttle on some of the stuff that's enabled the network to get where it is now. And now it's got to a point where I'm now working 2 to 3 days a week because I have money. I need some money.
I live with my mom, just makes it a lot easier, to be honest. And like, my mom's like kitchen is sort of like the unofficial consent in my office. But in terms of like self-care, shocking, to be honest. I have dreams about magazines. Genuinely, I have dreams, nightmares about magazines and like about events and stuff. And it's just all consuming, I guess, because we're all friends as well. It takes over like our social learning, because we're just like, it's difficult to just hang out. But I just say to my friends, you've got to come to the events if you want to see us, so you've got to buy a ticket and come through. And if they don't, then they get deaded off, basically.
So something that is kind of links all of our platforms is that we all, in some way or another, define the mainstream in a way. What do you think the mainstream can learn from platforms like ours? So we maybe start with Consented?
Stop being so fucking racist. I don't think there's anything that the mainstream can learn, because the mainstream is built to maintain like a status quo. Like, it has to exist to like recreate oppressions. And I think the only way that the mainstream sort of moves around that is if something is cool or is like interesting at the time. So you will hear like people of colour platforms because it's sort of like cool and in fashion. But it's like only a bit of sort of like window dressing to the fact that they're violently reproducing the logic of capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, and all of these things, because that's what it exists to do. So I don't really think there's anything they can learn. But I guess for us, what we learn is that if you look at Question Time and see how pale and male it is, we just, when we did our panels, were like, it needs to look like the opposite of that. And that was useful.
Yeah, I'd say, using it personally as like a barometer of what not to do is probably the way that we can learn from it. And then I guess what they could learn, actually, I don't know, I agree with you. It's like, it exists to sustain systems already, and it also, especially for what we do, it exists to perpetuate consumerism, so you're only going to get what is superficial out of whatever act of like political violence is in vogue. So I think the one thing that would be good is if it learned how to use language better and not just like reproduce violent and like stigmatizing language over and over again, like thoughtlessly, even while it's like trying to do good things. An example that happened today is Rennie de Lodge is on the cover of Stylist, which is incredible, and I picked it up for the first time ever, I think, because she was on it, and then in the first paragraph it had like explicitly transphobic language to describe the Walthamstow cafe they were in, to like add colour and show that it was like grimy. It was awful. I think repetitive thoughtlessness, even whilst trying to do good, is so mindless. And like, I don't think that they could learn that from us, because they're not going to listen to us. But I think it's what should be learned, if possible. That was very earnest. I feel like I'm the very earnest one here.
Oh, you guys have a really good answer. Really good. I agree with what they said. And I guess what I would add, because I guess now I technically work in the media, is that they should just hire people and let them just do whatever they want, because that's what I do and that seems to be working. It's not like a foolproof plan, because we've had some really kind of terrible situations unfold, but we've also had some really great things unfold. I actually just stopped paying attention to the media. Like, I literally open up my laptop and go onto like the Guardian and the Daily Mail for balance on the day of a recording of the episode, because I have no idea what's happening in this world, because it's just so horrible and mentally draining. So I guess what they could learn to do is kind of report on the positive sides of being like an ethnic minority or other genders. Like, it could just be a little bit more balanced. But it's probably not going to be, and I'm not that hopeful, so stick with the fringe platforms, they're doing great.
All three of your platforms have given quite a lot of space to talk about mental health. So you both had like an issue of a magazine dedicated to it, and you've also had quite a few guests. the mainstream doesn't really talk about mental health well or very productively unless it's convenient, I suppose. Why was mental health so important for you to cover?
Me, mostly because I am deeply afflicted by depression and anxiety almost every single year. So it was very personal to me, and then I had a family member go through a crisis where I had a section them, and that's a heavy topic. Once I got to the hospital, when they got sectioned, it was like all black women, and then on the men's floor it was all black men, and I was like, whoa. I don't really, like, you don't, until I was confronted with it, I didn't realise the extent of that problem. And when it hits you, it's like one of those things where you don't realise like how deeply troubling that is, and when you start to kind of dig around and see the kind of care that people receive specifically as ethnic minorities in the system, it's so shocking, so appalling that I was like, there's no way I can't not talk about it as someone that's affected and also could equally be in crisis at a later stage of my life, because you don't know what's going to happen. So it was very important for me to definitely kind of lend a voice to people. And I've had, like, the last time I was at General Assembly, someone said, like, you know that episode of Mental Health did save my life, and it saved a friend's life. And I was like, whoa. Well, that's what I do this for. So it's personal. That's why I cover it.
Yeah, I would echo it's personal. And also because, like you said, it's either talked about if it's convenient or talked about in a way that's very palatable. So very recently, people have started to talk a lot more about depression mainly and anxiety, but in a very like naive time to talk, we've got to talk about it. It's like, yeah, well, that's only the first step unless you dig deeper and you actually support people and provide services and don't just present, like, don't just talk about the palatable manifestations of mental health problems. You're not actually doing anything. You're just being quite self-congratulatory about it. And so that's one reason why we did it. And the other reason was we actually did it on Mind, which is slightly different, is because we wanted to challenge ourselves. We wanted to see if we could make something tangible that is very intangible. So not just mental health, but like how we interact with each other and our perceptions of each other and how psychology and psychiatry affects the way that we understand science in the world and stuff. And it was just, it was one of those things that we thought we'd be really proud of if we did it. So it's actually quite self-aggrandizing as well. So never mind.
Yeah, I'd say for me, like, yeah, my dad was just like an incredibly emotionally abusive alcoholic, like a really serious alcoholic. And growing up, me and my sister spent a lot of time sort of trying to parent him, trying to save him from himself, I guess, and trying to make him better. And I think in the process, I damaged myself quite significantly. And then when I tried to like understand these things, I realized how much it affected me. And then I sort of like, I guess, linked it to like wider issues. And obviously, I love a bit of Frantz Fanon and like post-colonialism and things like that. And these things are hugely applicable to current mental health problems that certain people have. And I think if you talk about mental health, the sort of Prince Harry and the royal family, sort of the crass obsession with this campaign that they're running, it just doesn't never get to the bottom of a problem. And I think we have to acknowledge that certain types of bodies are conditioned to suffer from mental health problems, and certain people are conditioned to thrive at the expense of other people. And for me, there's no point in talking about something like mental health without talking about like colonialism or patriarchy or these other systems of oppression in which we live under, because as long as we live under those, we're, some of us are always going to be a bit unhappy, unfortunately. And that's kind of sort of what we try to do in the magazine, for better or for worse.
I mean, this is like a whole topic that we could just talk about now, really. I mean, we've done mental health, but not nearly to the depth that it should be done to, and it's something that we definitely want to revisit. I kind of want to go back to a little bit in terms of when we were talking about mainstream media and what they can learn from us, and then I kind of got a vibe of almost like censorship in terms of, so you mentioned about the transphobic language, and a lot of the, some of the, I don't want to say barriers, but some of the questions that I get asked, or some people tell me, they're like, oh, but if you're telling me that I can't say this, that's censoring my language. How do you deal with those in your platforms?
Ignore them. You get told stuff all the time. I don't care. I don't have the patience. You do not pay me to teach you. I'm not a teacher. I ignore those, to be honest. There is some people, there are enough people in this world who are educated or woke enough to want to go at that person in their mentions, and I will let them do it because I do not have the time. So that's my answer.
Stick to print and then people can't come for you in their mentions.
Wise.
Yeah, I'd say show me a straight white man who says he's insensitive and I'll show you a liar. To be honest, and I just think that people just need, some people just like are all minor and just go on about these sort of people. And we had an event, we did an event a while ago on, I can't remember, it was on democracy, and like, is democracy in crisis? And someone got up and announced themselves as a Trump supporter, which is very like at odds with the sort of people who come to our event, and sort of was like, you know, I feel like this isn't a safe space for me as a Trump supporter. You know, why are you platforming these views? And I was just sort of like, just turn on the TV if you want to see these hateful views platformed. And like, this is not what we're about. You know, it's meant to be, for want of a better term, a counter-hegemonic project, if you like. And that is the hegemony. Like, that's mainstream. Like, these ideas are so mainstream. And like, the fact of the matter is, like, one of my guests, Gracie, was like, as a black woman, I couldn't go to a Trump event without fear of being killed. And like, this person was able to come to the event and feel safe enough to express these outlandish and outrageous views. And I think these people honestly just need to shut up and
We went to an event that Amy and I by Barbara, who was on episode number 2 about beauty, and she had black women talking about the platforms that they created. And something that really surprised me and was kind of like a wake up, I suppose, to our own privilege is that she talked about how much hate she got online and how much everyone else in the room got. And that was something that, as though we've had a bit, but it's actually not been anywhere near as much as the other women in the room, and that was quite a wake up call. So I guess my question was, what barriers have you come up against and how did you overcome them?
I'm a white woman, there aren't actually that many. I'm a white cis woman. At most, I'm like a token in a room of straight people, but that doesn't happen that often anymore. So like, on a personal level, that is. And I think on a ladybeard level as well, we all have a lot of privilege. So it would be facetious for us to say that we had barriers beyond our own well-being, as in mental health and like self-care and all of that stuff. Because we don't face systemic barriers in the way that other people do, but we just work with people who face more barriers and try and platform them. So we just try and not be a barrier for other people, I guess.
Yeah, I guess likewise, we try not to be barriers for other people. And just like me and Mike are still two straight blokes, so it's kind of a bit more calm for us, and Mike's like white as well, so like he wouldn't know a barrier to smack him in the face.
Poor Mike.
Yeah, that's what he wants you to say.
Yeah, don't
get so indoctrinated.
Sorry, what was the question? It was about barriers, right? Oh god.
They can be more broad, like about the setting of the project.
Where to begin? So we are two black women on a show. The show is called Melanin Millennials. I had to pause to say that. And we get like people kind of making assumptions, usually straight white men, funnily enough, making assumptions about what the show's gonna be. There was that really grotesque human that Barbara faced up against on Channel 4. I don't know if anyone saw that, about the alt-right. There was like a mini doc on like the alt-right and the rise of it. It was awful. I don't remember the idiot's name, but he basically waved a refugee paper in Barbara Lentini's face, saying, why does she take one in? And that was just kind of like symbolic of like everything that we go through as like black women online that are even marginally outspoken. There's always someone trying to police what we say, police how we think, police what we look like, just, yeah, all of that. And I think like the worst that I personally had was when I faced off with Nigel Farage at one time, and he sent his army of racists to me on Twitter. So for 3 days I went through pure and utter hell with like all these white men just kind of saying, you're racist. And eventually I remember like looking, like obsessively watching footage back, like, did I say something racist? I don't think I. And it's really, it's so true, especially after 3 days of like unadulterated, like an attack on your mental health, an attack on your being, an attack on yourself. It's very triggering, but it's one of those things that, like, Diana Abbott goes through that every single day. Like, I actually have to, like, I've toned down my trauma, like, because I think trauma's kind of funny. But I've had to stop because I'm like, this is actually really harmful. I don't know how some people manage to go through that. And I really commend Diana Abbott. I don't agree with her politics, but she goes through that every day. So that's just, like, one of the many barriers that we go through. But in terms of, like, the podcast and like, just podcasting in general, we had like a really hard time when we started out. Like, access to iTunes, for example, was extremely difficult for us. Getting like into meeting rooms with like some of the key partners in the beginning, which is like non-existent. Like, people would just ignore us until we kind of landed in the Guardian one time, and they're like, "Oh, hi, we want to know you now. You guys seem cool." And I'm like, so we had to be in like quite mainstream media for you to like recognize that we have voices that matter. So there is like a lot of crap happening, but it's slightly getting better. But the trolling of black women, it's really grotesque, and there's not enough done about it.
Have you guys ever been told to almost like tone down your identities or your platforms to be more palatable to a white, cis, heteronormative media?
Well, we never really tried to sell it to anyone, so no one's ever asked us to, because we don't have ads either. We're very self-contained, I think, probably, but who knows? I mean, hopefully down in a few years we'll actually be viable business people, because we are terrible business people. It's like just print the magazine, like, let's just get it done, like, don't do anything to try and grow, which is maybe not good, but probably shouldn't be saying that on here. We're great and you should support us.
You all talked about some of the things that have been tricky, whether it's like working with like co-editors or co-creators, or the backlash you can face online, and managing self-care and time and money and all of this stuff. I want to know what makes it worth it. I want to know why you keep doing it and what makes it worth it. I can tell you that for me, it's anytime anyone says I listened to your episode and I really liked it. And even more so when someone says like that topic really resonated with me, like you mentioned before. So what makes it worth it for you?
The listeners. I realised pretty early on, like, despite everything that's happening, the fact that this is bigger than me now, so even if I wanted to quit, which I kind of don't, but if I wanted to, I'm kind of like, there's tens of thousands of people that are just like, where's the episode? It's late, and I would like my episode. And I'm like, there's a lot of pressure on that, it's very overwhelming, but it's also kind of rewarding because there have been enough people to say, like, you are my self-care, and I don't want to not be someone's self-love. I kind of do, but I don't want to take that away from someone if that's what they feel like they need, and until there's more of us doing it, that they've got so much choice that they don't need someone more than time, then I can retire like Sex and the City did recently.
Yeah, I guess for us it's like, yeah, it's a bit of a struggle sometimes, and like I said, I have nightmares about the magazine. A magazine's like killing me in my dreams. But like, I guess quite like with my co-editors, like three amazing people, and we have like wonderful conversations, and I think I'm actually quite lucky. I get to like read books and like listen to some like really interesting people, and I think that's a really like wonderful thing when some people are like the 9-to-5 office grinds and commuting and the train and stuff. So I guess it is like that makes it worth it to us. And also, yeah, when people say like, oh, I really like that, or people shut down the transport, it's always quite validating.
I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit about activism, I guess. So activism, we kind of talked about it a little bit earlier, in that it's kind of painted as this act that you have to be marching somewhere, you have to be on hunger strike somewhere. Do you guys consider yourselves activists at all?
I'm not sure if it's like a moniker you can give yourself. I just think sometimes it's a bit like, I don't know, it's so crazy when people are like, you know, I am an activist, but like, I am a revolutionary or something like that. Is it something you can, is it a title you can give yourself? I don't know, but what does it mean, I guess? If you're actively doing something, you are an activist, I guess, by very nature. I wouldn't say that we bill ourselves as activists, but I guess we try to support groups who do that. So we're doing an event on June 15th, little plug, everyone, June 15th. Called Is a State as Well as Possible, which is like a fundraiser for the Hand Care Anti-Race Network, which I guess they are like legitimately activists. so we'll raise funds for them, and I guess that's how we would try to support groups like that.
What about being young
people
being an activist, or is your platform
formal activism? I wouldn't call myself an activist because I have like a very staunch anti-march philosophy personally, because I'm more like, when you're starting to throw the molotovs, you'll fight me. When it's like proper violent, I'll be there. But yeah, I wouldn't say I'm an activist. I think people give us that label, and I'm okay with people giving me that. And I'm okay with people giving the podcast that as well. So people want to say millennials is a form of activism, that's fine. People want to say self-care, that's fine. People want to say it's trash, that's also fine. Anything is fine. But me, myself, no, I'm not an activist, but I am acutely aware of what's going on. I'm very actively doing something, so yeah.
I think, oh, that was real slow, wasn't it? I think it would be unfair for us to call ourselves activists, because for me, more personally, I think it's when you're doing something that has a concrete goal and you actively take things down and you can see change happening. And whilst I think what we all do is very important in like world of media or whatever, you don't get those kind of concrete changes. And I think that there are activists who do actively, God, repetition of that word, man, who do these things and you can see change and they're doing like incredible things, who deserve way more praise than I think that Ladybird does. Like Sisters Uncut is phenomenal, and I think that's like peak activism. Whereas I think what we do is, I mean, it's media, which is like wonderful and powerful and like impacts how we see ourselves and each other, but it's not governmental change, you know? So right. Yes and no.
But surely it starts from somewhere, and like as the media, as the form of media, that change is going to start somewhere.
Oh no, I do totally agree with that. I just think as Scythe, maybe not as Ladybird, because I've spoken to the other girls, I think it's active concrete change that affects lives in concrete ways. And maybe I'm, you know, shitting on what we do by saying that.
Actually, we all have a role to play. I think I completely agree with you, and I also think sometimes even by doing something smaller, as it's like creating a space, and then you realise how many people need that space, like as a form of self-care, we're all contributing, hopefully, to something bigger. I think you've had a lot from Elena and I asking questions, and I think it's time to open it up to the audience and see if you guys have got any questions. So if you have a question, raise your hand and then shout it loudly, right? And then we'll repeat it so that's in the microphones. Yeah.
So if we're sat in the audience and we're like, oh my god, I've got a great idea, but I don't know what to do about it, what would be your advice to people that will start a platform?
Do it. Buy a domain name, or whatever you want to call it, or think of a name, that's always a good place to start. Then buy a domain name, as soon as you know, and buy all of them as well. Yeah, just start it. I think Satya and I discussed it from February 2015. We started recording in late October of 2015. So there was a lot of conversation in there. She was bored for most of that, so it didn't happen. But just do it and start small and recognize that maybe like the first iterations of your idea are going to be really shit. So either toss them out or keep them for, you know, your own personal reasons. It will get better over time. Like, we're definitely much better at podcasting than we were like a year ago. And it also sounds a lot better than it did a year ago.
Yeah. I would just message that friend that you were thinking about doing it with, and then be like, okay, we'll have coffee this Saturday, and then you set up a plan. And like, we have a secret Ladybird issue that we did in 2013 that is just in my mum's basement and nobody can see it because it's shameful, but we did it, and now we can do it in a way that we actually let people read. Yeah. So it's baby steps, but you know, eventually you start actually walking.
Our episode number one on privilege, I was really embarrassed about it. Well, no, I love it as a topic, but as you listen back to it, having come really later in the podcasting and learning how to ask questions or how to edit or all of those things, I feel like we've come a long way. But today, I met somebody in the audience and privilege is one of their favourite episodes. So, even the little scrappy ones, I guess, the first ones are sometimes scrappy. Did you have any tips for starting something?
No, likewise, just keep it going.
Yeah, I imagine that working on, this is for all of you, working on sort of a passion project where you're not really obligated to show up or be there can get quite exhausting, and it can feel maybe easy to take a step back or just give up entirely, especially maybe in the beginning. So I'm just wondering if you guys have had those moments before, and if so, like, what kind of motivated you to just get over it and keep going?
Well, I was deeply unemployed when we started doing it, and we all were, and like, it was the only thing that felt like it was giving us structure, and like, because there are quite a few of us, everyone at some point is underemployed or unemployed, and they're the ones who are like, right, okay guys, we've got to keep going, and I'm like, I'm so tired, it's been 9 to 6 all week, and they're like, no, we're meeting tomorrow, and so it just like, you kind of like, you push each other, and then you get the good bits, and they're so good, and like, you experience the joy of actually making it, and you remember that for a bit, but then you forget because it's like childbirth and you just do it again. But then your friends keep asking you about it, like, when you're going to have another kid, when's the next magazine coming out? You're like, oh, fuck, okay, let's start gestating, like, okay, okay.
So. That was a really nice analogy. I think it was a lot easier because we were kind of responsible to the founder of the network in a way, so there was like this third person, because even though we're friends and we're probably individually just a bit ridiculous, time wasty, the fact that he was like, so when is the next recording? We're recording this, we're recording once a week, and that schedule was there, and then there was kind of this accountability between the two of us, and then because it grew so fast, so quickly, like within months we were on like thousands of listeners, we were really kind of held to account by them, like a little bit, so it was like, yeah, technically we could have just like dropped out for a week or two, but then there was actually at least one person in our audience who was like, but the episode is late, it might happen. So we've been quite fortunate. So when we went on like a 4 week hiatus, we were getting like all of these tweets like, when are you coming back? When are you coming back? It's been 3 weeks. And I was like, I don't know, I'm gonna come back, when we come back. Like, it did not give a date, but we definitely got questions. So there was like the people that support you asking you and holding you accountable. So that kept us going for sure.
For us, a lot of day goes by without a crisis. But there's four of us, so we can just gas each other up and we'll just be like, yeah, it's fine, isn't it? And then your boss will be like, yeah, it's fine. And then afterwards, we just think it's all fine. It sort of works quite well, to be honest. And if not, because like, Mike is just like a white man walking, talking, pillar of mediocrity and and that confidence then can like ooze into us, and we all feel more confident just by being in his proximity. Like radiation poisoning. It's gonna be better.
Yeah, so I think I don't really think I can follow on from that really.
Yeah.
I think for us it really helped adding some sort of structure to it, in that I definitely couldn't have done this on my own, and I think for us, because it's a passion project, it's not something that we're like paid to do or we're employed to do, I need Sid for this podcast, and so I think, and it kind of resonates the same with what we've all said, in that like, you have someone else there to like, spur you on. So the amount of times I've called Sid and freaked out about something, and then Sid's just been like, okay, that's fine. And then you're like, oh shit, yeah, that's fine.
The way that we found the thing worked well is to like create little deadlines for yourself. It's okay, so that by this time we would have found the guest, by this time we would have recorded the guest. And before you know it, you're looking at your diary, and you're like, oh, it's that week and I should have done this by then. Okay, so that gives you a bit of a kick. And then also just keep doing it with someone that cares about it and work together. So when I'm really busy, I'll chat with Elaine, I'll be like, listen, I really can't research the guest this week, can you do it? And then she will take over. And then we'll keep swinging. And as things get busier and busier, we're having more of these crisis chats and then lunch breaks. Keep going. And then you go do something, and then you put something out there, and people say, oh my gosh, that's really meant something to me, and it kind of just makes it worth it. It's worth the passion, it's worth the energy.
Yeah. I feel like we can start a podcast about like panicked phone calls in the corridor at work. Like, yeah, the amount of times that corridor at work is probably
see me in tears on the phone to sit over something.
And make it better, but it's not the tears.
Yeah.
Do we have any final questions? Yeah, go for it.
What does feminism mean to you?
Good question. What does feminism mean to you?
Come on.
You want to begin? Easy, easy. Shame. Do you want to go first, Ellie? Come on.
Set me up to mansplain later. No chance.
I didn't have to.
My sister's like, don't be mansplaining. No.
A lot?
Potentially. I could. Well, I sound like a ghost. And then you kind of ask me to get me. It means a lot, and it's like, given the framework for a lot of what we do, and it's the driving force and motivation behind a lot of the incredible people I know, in terms of giving a name to something that we felt our whole lives, and giving a way to understand how and why things happen to us the way that they do, and it's something to fight against as well. I don't know if that's the answer you're looking for, but it's what you're getting. So.
I saw this question on the sheet and I hoped to say it would never come up. And now it has. What does feminism mean to me? So, early in life, I was like, I guess I'm anti-feminist. I just didn't think it was like a thing. And I was like, feminism is stronger. Like, what are we talking about? This is not up for debate. So I was a terrible human being when I was 16. And now, since doing this podcast, I found that I've kind of really come into it a little bit. I've come to understand what it means, and have a very complicated relationship with feminism in that, as a black woman, I feel very much excluded from much of the conversations around it. I feel that it's not relevant or applicable in any way, shape, or form to me. And then on the other side, I have been able to form some really great friendships, some really great personal and business relationships because of what feminism is and the kind of active movement that there is, especially around intersectionality, like Sidney, just through like just our kind of common understanding and love of feminism. So, or curiosity. Guess it's very conflicted for me. There is that kind of whole separate principle of womanism, which is kind of more applicable to black women, that I kind of subscribe to a little bit, which is a lot more intersectional understanding of the struggle. So it does mean a lot to me, but it's very complicated at the same time.
I think that, like, so the question that we got asked on the sheet was like, would you call yourself a feminist, right? And I would say that, like, could a white person call themselves anti-racist? And I'd probably say no, because, like, I was born to be a misogynist, just because that's, like, the world in which we were brought up in. And I think that, like, it's always a bit disingenuous. Like, Justin Trudeau was like, this is what feminism looks like. I remember the T-shirt that did Clint War one, and then implemented, like, really brutal austerity, which obviously, as part of a coalition government, which obviously hurt women, like, disproportionately, hurt the enemy people disproportionately. So I think that, like, yeah, I just don't know, like, a man, like, I don't think it's a monarchy you can give yourself again. And I think that, like, it's something we would always try to support, and everyone latterly who our co-editors are, like, committed, like, feminists, and obviously we do our best to, like, listen to them. Let them rule the roost. Feminists take over.
The other thing that I would add that you reminded me of that T-shirt is that those T-shirts, they were made in horrific conditions in Bangladesh, which is where majority of our clothing comes from. And it's like such a succinct example of the way that consumerism and corporations have co-opted feminism. So like feminism in the mainstream media is a superficial moniker that is Taylor Swift, girl power, squad, girls. Oh my God, they're all friends in that Instagram post. I can't believe it. They're elevating each other. And that's it. Or it's like just bullshit. And it's not looking into what those structures actually mean on the ground level, not looking at how misogyny and sexism affects working class women, affects black women, affects non-binary people, affects every manifestation of not a cis white straight man. And that is what it should be. It's not what it is on billboards. And I think that what's great about things like tonight, and I guess what we're trying to do is to not do that and try and kind of bring those two manifestations as close together as possible, whether or not we can succeed. I mean, it's capitalism and consumerism. It's probably not, we can't take it down personally, but at least it's like, and I don't buy those fucking t-shirts. They are definitely made by kids. Like, don't do it. Don't wear it as a slogan, try and like embody it.
I think for me, and maybe also to an extent later too, feminism has enabled me to ask questions. So, about whose responsibility it is. So, for example, if I'm being catcalled in the street, is it actually my fault, or is it actually the fault of the person who's saying that thing? It's like a really basic example. But it's also made me think about emotional labour, and the amount of emotional labour I might put into like a podcast, or into like work with conversations, and like actually made me think and ask a lot of questions of myself. And also, it's about trying to be intersectional, and like it's not easy, you know, looking at your own privilege and trying to kind of like anticipate the questions that people might ask of you or might challenge you on, to try and pull other people in when you can, to make a mistake and then to apologise for it and to get back on it. I mean, it shouldn't be easy, right? But for me, feminism is the ongoing challenge of trying to figure out what I can do to make the best use of the resources that I have access to, and trying to just be a better person. And I kind of like that ongoing challenge. So feminism for me is the gateway for me to even being able to think about other people's experiences and how I can support them, which I guess links us back up to all of the platforms that we've created and how we've tried to do that.
Oh God. I don't know how I can match that. Yeah, feminism, for me, it's definitely been a journey. So when we first started this podcast, you can see in the postcard I sent Sid, I said that I wanted to start a podcast around feminism and specifically around women's issues. And I remember meeting up with Sid, and she was like, "Okay, I'm happy to do a podcast, but it has to be intersectional." And I had no idea what that meant. And so for me, feminism has taken it's had all its variations. You know, I don't know how abstract we want to get with it, but it's something that's like almost kind of become like a guiding compass, and that I think about feminism in like every interaction that I have, whether it's at work, or whether it's chatting to my housemates about everything.
I think we're coming to the end of the podcast episode. Well, actually, I will ask you very quickly just to give us a quick sentence about where we can find out more about what you're doing, how people can support you, and if you've got anything that's coming up you'd like people to support you with. Do you want to begin with an idea?
The issue's not coming out until like October, November, so keep your eyes and ears peeled after summer. And we're going to have a couple of events, and we're going to be relaunching our website soon, so it'll be much nicer soon. Basically nothing at the moment. We're working on it, I promise.
Can you still buy any of your issues?
No, they're sold out. But, sorry. Give us money, we'll reprint. just like fork.
You can find me at Melanin Mill, that's MILLE at the end, on Twitter. Melanin Millennials everywhere else, which is SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, wherever. And also, we have a huge podcast festival that I may have mentioned once or twice, celebrating people of colour in podcasting, featuring like Another Round, The Friends Zone, which is a mental health and wellness podcast from the States, another podcast that I can't talk about because they haven't announced themselves yet, and we're waiting for them to do it. But it's a huge, huge celebration with Melanie Millennials there. Some of you guys here, actually. We'll talk. But like a massive celebration of UK podcasting, American podcasting, and just the general black experience. So you can get, if you want to come along and that's going to help support and fund our studio, the Shout Out Network Studios, you can get things at solarfestival.com.
Okay, we've got so many. So June 15th again, we've got the fundraiser, the end of June 18th at Birkbeck University, we've got four workshops called Dissecting Sex, which my mum is coming to. It's about politics, not the practice. But I guess how the politics informs the practice. So who knows, mum could be a pretty interesting day. And then July 9th, we've got our third magazine launch, which we're putting together at the moment. and 30th of July we've got a day of decolonizing the partition. So yeah, white people come, pay reparations of some kind, feel better about themselves, and you pay for these events. And we've got magazines on, just doing mining magazines.
Yeah, amazing. I think that's pretty much it. Yeah,
thank you very much.